violence at NYU and Yale, arresting over 200 people, including students and professors. We'll speak to the head of Columbia's Institute for the Study of Human Rights.
The faculty at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights felt it was to make a strong statement condemning the repressive actions against student protests, the rights of students to protest peacefully, and freedoms of speech on campus.
We'll also look back at the historic 1968 student occupation at Columbia University, which began 56 years ago today. Then we'll speak to the pioneering union organizer, Jane McAlevey, on the fight for labor rights and her own personal fight against terminal cancer.
I'm looking forward to discussing the incredible victory by 1,300 Volkswagen workers this past Friday in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was a huge and really important breakthrough in the U.S. South. And I'm also looking forward to sharing 25 years of lessons about what kind of organizing is required to pull off a win like the workers just did in the South.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Civil defense workers in Gaza have now recovered at least three bodies buried in a grave at the Nasser Medical Complex in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. Earlier today, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said he was horrified by the grave, which was found 2 weeks after Israeli forces ended their siege on the hospital. Some of the bodies found had their hands tied and their backs. Today marks 200 days since Israel launched its assault on Gaza. On Monday, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Tlaleng Mofokeng, warned the Israeli war be generations.
Mental health, intergenerational trauma, the kinds of acute assistance, medical debriefing, psychological debriefing that many children still have not received is of serious concern. And often, of course, we see the physical injury, and because it's physical, one can appreciate the severity of it. But the acute mental distress that will then turn into anxiety and other kinds of mental illnesses later on in life is really, really important to start thinking about.
An independent UN commission says Israel's offered no evidence to back up its allegations that employees of the UN aid agency UNRWA participated in the October 7th attacks by Hamas. Allegations by Israel led many countries to temporarily cut off funding just as the humanitarian crisis was intensifying in Gaza. U.S. lawmakers have banned UNRWA funding for the next year. Palestinian solidarity protests and encampments are spreading across college campuses around the country, inspired by the solidarity encampment at Columbia University. Here in New York, police raided a student encampment at New York University Monday night. Police arrested more than 150 people, including students and faculty. Earlier on Monday, police at Yale University arrested 60 protesters, including 47 students who'd set up a campus encampment to demand the school divest from weapons manufacturers. At Columbia University, the student encampment has entered its seventh day. On Monday night, about 100 student protesters and faculty took part in a Gaza Liberation Seder to mark the start of the Jewish holiday of Passover. Student encampments are now in place at numerous other schools, including the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, the University of California, Berkeley, the University of Maryland, MIT, and Emerson College in Boston. Yasser Muniff is a professor.
I want Emerson to listen to the students, hear them, understand their perspective, also open a space for a discussion of Palestine, the discussion of the genocide in Palestine, in Gaza, and allow the student to express themselves. Freedom of speech, academic freedom.
Best news, PEN America's canceled its award ceremony after roughly half of this year's nominees withdrew from literary prizes to protest what they called PEN's complicity in normalizing genocide, unquote. The estate of Jean Stein, which awards a $75,000 prize each year, requested the money be directed instead to the PEN's relief fund. Children are Katrina and Wendy Vandenhoevel. Google has fired another 20 workers in retaliation for last week's protest against Project Nimbus, Google's cloud computing contract with Israel. The firings reportedly included workers who were simply bystanders during the sit-in. In a Manhattan courtroom, both the prosecution and defense delivered opening statements Monday in Donald Trump's criminal hush money case, the first of four criminal cases Trump is facing. Prosecutors said Trump's $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels in 2016 and his effort to cover it up by falsifying business records constituted, quote, election fraud, pure and simple, unquote. Meanwhile, Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, argued the former president did anything illegal, saying nothing wrong with trying to influence an election, unquote. The court heard briefly from the prosecution's first witness, David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer. He's taking the stand again today. The court will also consider arguments from prosecutors that Trump has repeatedly violated his gag order. Meanwhile, Trump's valet, Walt Nauta, a co-defendant in Trump's classified documents case, was reportedly told he would be pardoned if he lied to the FBI and Trump was reelected as president. The conservative-ruled U.S. Supreme Court appeared to side with an Oregon city's crackdown on unhoused people in a key case that could have devastating implications nationwide. The case centers around the small city of Grants Pass, Oregon, which has banned people from sleeping with a blanket or pillow on any public land, despite not having public shelters. Those who violate the ban can face hundreds of dollars in fines. Liberal Justice Elena Kagan highlighted the absurdity of the city's ban.
Well, sleeping is a biological necessity. It's sort of like breathing. I mean, you could say breathing is conduct, too. But presumably, you would not think that it's criminalized breathing in public.
Fellow liberal justice Sonia Sotomayor also challenged the Grants Pass attorney, arguing the city does not arrest babies or stargazers who bring blankets to public parks.
Where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lack compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?
Outside the Supreme Court, hundreds of housing justice advocates gathered to demonstrate. Among those addressing the crowd was Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign.
Law crime to be poor are unjust laws that would paralyze homeless folk for sleeping in public parks is unjust, excessive, and cruel and unusual punishment has no place in America.
The United Kingdom's highly contested plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda is set to become law after it was passed by the House of Lords Monday. Despite ongoing questions over its lawfulness, Conservative Prime Minister Rishi Sunak vowed to begin the deportation flights in 10 to 12 weeks.
But we are ready. Plans are in place. And these flights will go come what may. No foreign court will stop us from getting flights off.
The plan was agreed to by Rwanda and the UK 2 years ago, but has faced intense criticism from rights groups. Monday's bill overrides a UK Supreme Court ruling from last year, which found the policy unconstitutional. UN human rights experts have asked the UK to reconsider the plan and warned aviation authorities against participating in the deportation flights, citing a possible violation of international human rights laws. In related news, just hours ago, local authorities say at least five people, including a seven-year-old girl, died as they attempted to cross the English Channel from France in an overcrowded boat. Rescue operations are still underway. In Mexico, two mayoral candidates were killed Friday, Noe Ramos in Tamaulipas state and Alberto Garcia in Oaxaca. 17 candidates have been murdered in the run-up to the June 2nd election in Mexico, where drug cartels often target members as they seek to control local police department and municipal authorities. The Biden administration Monday issued a new rule protecting the privacy of patients seeking reproductive health care. The rule, which bars the disclosure of patients' medical records, applies even when someone travels out of state for an abortion or IVF or their reproductive health care. President Biden announced a $7 billion investment in solar energy Monday, which was Earth Day. The money, which comes from the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, will fund dozens of solar projects around the country and create an estimated 200,000 jobs. Biden made the announcement in Virginia's Prince William Forest Park, flanked by Senators Bernie Sanders and Ed Markey and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I will put tens of thousands of young people to work at the forefront of our climate resilience, energy future, clean energy future. Today, I'm proud to announce that Americans across the country can now apply to become the first members of the American Climate Corps. We're recruiting for over 2,000 positions in 36 states to start with, in Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, with many on the way.
Environmental activists from around the world are gathered in New York this week, where they held a first-of-its-kind Earth Day hearing on Citigroup's environmental racism Monday. Citibank is the world's second-largest funder of coal, oil and gas. Rashida Azan is a Black environmental leader from Sulphur, Louisiana, who's been leading the fight against the Citibank-funded LNG build-out in her community.
We are calling for Citibank to commit to end funding and financing and expanding liquefied methane gas projects and their parent companies, including all projects that have already been built and those that have not reached a final investment decision. This is a critical time for Citi to assess climate, community, and human rights impacts of the methane gas sector.
Students from Columbia, Tulane, and the University of Virginia filed complaints with their state's attorneys general, arguing their universities' fossil fuel investments are illegal and counter to their missions. The students cite a law which requires nonprofit institutions to prioritize charitable purposes when they invest, despite the hypocrisy of the colleges conducting climate research while hoping to financially fuel the crisis. And in South Korea, a court heard from youth climate activists and their families who accused the government of failing to meaningfully act on climate change. It's believed to be the first such case in Asia. Similar cases have been filed in Europe and the U.S. This is the mother of two children plaintiff.
Carbon emission reduction keeps getting pushed back as if it is a homework that can be done later. But that burden will be what are eventually.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we speak to tutors at Columbia and New York University. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As Israel's assault on Gaza enters its 200th day, Palestine solidarity protests and encampments are spreading on college campuses across the United States, inspired by the Gaza solidarity encampment at Columbia University. Here in New York, police raided an encampment at New York University Monday night. Police arrested more than 150 people, including students and 20 faculty members. Earlier on Monday, police at Yale University did 60 protesters, including 47 students who'd set up an encampment to demand the school divest from weapons manufacturers. At Columbia, the student encampment has entered its seventh day. On Monday night, about 100 Columbia student protesters and faculty took part in a Gaza Liberation Seder to mark the start of the Jewish holiday of Passover, Pesach. On Monday, hundreds of Columbia professors held a mass walkout. This is Columbia history professor Christopher Brown.
Thursday, April 1820, remembered as a full day in Columbia's history. The president's decision to send riot police to pick up peaceful protesters on our campus was unprecedented, unjustified, disproportionate, divisive, and dangerous.
Yeah. Student encampments are now in place at numerous other schools, University of Ann Arbor, University of California, Berkeley, University of Maryland, MIT, and Emerson College in Boston. We're joined now by two professors. Bauder is Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He's the Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of Human Rights, which put out a public statement condemned oppression of student protests at Columbia and the calling in of the New York police, who made over 100 arrests. Also with us, New York University professor Helga Tewil-Suri. She's a leading Palestinian-American scholar of media, culture, and communication, co-editor of the book Gaza as Metaphor. Okay, we're going to be with New York University, with Professor Tewil-Suri. You have been at the encampment at NYU Monday morning at 4, and you just came from jail support, where, what, over 140 people, including 20 of your peers, NYU professors, were arrested. Can you explain what's going on at NYU?
So the students decided to start an encampment yesterday, early in the morning, in support of Gaza, in support of Palestine, also kind of in support, obviously, of other students and Columbia and otherwise. And very early on already, from the very beginning of the first setup, the NYU security guards came and NYPD came. But quickly, kind of a sort of de-escalation, if you want, kind of took place between faculty members and security guards, and NYPD was peaceful all day long. There was a lot of sort of negotiation back and forth between the faculty and the security guards on behalf of the students. And at some point in the afternoon, kind of, you know, things like police presence was kind of escalating. And the negotiations kind of stopped. And at some point, the NYU security guards were like, all right, well, we're just... They made it pretty clear that NYPD presence was just sort of imminent at that point, and kind of started coming up with all kinds of reasons as to why they were going to show up and so on, kind of kept pushing the bar in different directions. And then the NYPD came. Faculty kind of had made a sort of front line kind of buffer zone at the very beginning. They were arrested very quickly. And then the police force kind of forced in their way into this sort of plaza where the students had their tents set up, and extremely kind of took down all the tents, were throwing chairs around, and then arrested all of the students that were there, and then also had a third wave of arrests of other people that were kind of still in that area as well. So, yeah, 20 faculty members ended up in prison. Were arrested, and I think the number of total arrests was around 145.
And Professor Tewil-Suri, was that at any time were the students in any way disrupting the classes in the university or the business of the university?
Not really. I mean, in the sense that, you know, they got there pretty early in the morning, and very quickly NYU security guard decided to kind of barricade that area. So if anybody was disrupting, it was actually NYU security and not the students, because they were the ones who kind of set up all the barriers and would forbid students from students, whether they were campment or just trying to get to class, would not actually let them access that way. So they had to kind of go all the way around and so on. And so there was very little movement in terms of, you know, letting people in or out of the encampment, and we had to sort of negotiate, like, for bathroom breaks and stuff like that. And, you know, the disruption, I mean, we're told that, oh, the disruption was part of the protest, right, and the chanting, and this, it's New York City, it's really loud, there was construction right across the street, so it's really hard for me to understand that that was a sort of disruption. So really the disruption, I think, was much more on the part of the security guards who really sort of blocked off that entire area.
And to your knowledge, did the administration or the president have any discussions with the NYU faculty before calling in the police?
So I myself and a number of my colleagues in terms of like NYU faculty sort of went back and forth numerous times with a couple of the deans and a couple and the head of NYU security. And so kind of negotiated sort of back and forth about, you know, can we let the kids out to the bathroom? Can we come in? Can we go out? Can we bring more people in? Can we bring more people out? But not directly with the president of the university, but just mostly the head of security. And a couple of times with the NYPD, certainly early in the morning. And, you know, I mean, one of the things we've seen the response of the president of the university saying that, oh, there was a breach in the barrier. And I mean, I could tell you I was there all day. That breach in the barrier is really not a breach in that sense. I mean, there were a couple that went in. I think the concern was as to whether or not we could control whether the people that were going on to the plaza were NYU students. And so we offered numerous times, like, well, we're happy to go around and kind of ask all the students for their ID cards. And at some point, the security guard said, okay, fine, we'll do this. And then suddenly they said no. And they sort of came up with all sorts of reasons as to why we weren't kind of following. Ultimately, you know, that we were trespassing on our own campus, right? I mean, it's a presumably private part of the university. And it was, you know, NYU students and NYU faculty that are then charged with saying and then violently kind of thrown out from that space.
I want to bring Professor Joseph Slaughter into this conversation. You're at Columbia, you're Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature there, and you're the Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. It was your president, Manushri Shafiq, who called out the New York Police Department. This was a day after she testified before Congress. Can you talk about your response to the encampment and then the arrest of over 100 students?
Thank you, Amy. I certainly can. So the response that we had at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights was that we immediately recognized the infringement of student rights to protest peacefully and freedoms of speech on campus and the threat, the dramatic threat it raised. The bringing police, the university president calling in the police, raised immediately, of course, the specter of 68, which I'm glad you'll be talking about. You'll be talking about a minute later. There are a number of things I would like to say about the bringing. We have actually, in the wake of 1968, a very strong set of university statutes that include things like protections for speech and protest on campus. They effectively are the constitution of Columbia University. They are the product of the good product of 1968, establishing systems of shared governance between faculty, students, and the administration. And there are emergency powers that the president has to protect faculty, students, the Columbia community in the case of imminent threat property on campus that are spelled out loosely in the university statutes. The president, however, has an absolute obligation, it's spelled out very clearly, to consult with the executive committee of the University Senate, which includes students and faculty, before bringing any external police forces onto campus. In this case, she approached with her stay of the Columbia encampment, which was a peaceful nonviolent protest, not disturbing, in my opinion, the Columbia environment, the Columbia campus, and certainly posing no personal property. She approached the Executive Committee of the University Senate, asking for their permission to invite the NYPD in to shut down, to squelch the protest. The executive committee, the faculty and the students on the executive committee voted unanimously to reject her request to bring in the university, to bring in New York police. She did it anyway, thus violating not only the statutes, in my opinion, certainly the long traditions of shared governance, the long traditions of protest and protections of speech on campus, as well as the compact between students, faculty, and the administration, act unilaterally, essentially throwing out the rule book and throwing out the Constitution, the statutes of the university.
And Professor Slaughter, this whole issue of within 24 hours students receiving notices of suspensions, what kind of a due process occurred here?
That's a great question, and I think something that's extremely important for people to understand. In the letter that President Shafik sent to the NYPD, the chief of police, asking them for their intervention, she claimed that the students were being suspended for violations of university policies, and that therefore they were trespassing on Columbia property. The students, the 108 students who were arrested, were charged with trespassing. However, in fact, the vast majority of those students, there were a number of exceptions from Barnard apparently, but the vast majority of those students were in fact not suspended until 24 hours after the arrests. The suspension notices that the students received now cite the arrests themselves as the as part of the cause for suspension. In other words, the logic was circulated in the New York Police Department on the premise that the students were trespassing when they hadn't yet been suspended, and they are now suspended on the premise that they had violated trespassing, New York trespassing laws, and therefore were guilty, therefore needed to be suspended and were guilty. In my opinion, the NYPD were called in false pretenses by the president of the university.
I wanted to get your response to the New York police chief, John Cho, said that President Shafik identified the demonstration as a clear and present danger, but that officers found the students to be peaceful and cooperative.
I think this is also something that's absolutely important for people to know. In fact, the John Chet Patrol said this, disavowed the language of clear and present danger. The president had used the language, in the exact language taken from the university statutes, of clear and present danger to the substantial functioning of the university. She did not, however, say that the students posed a clear and present danger to persons and property, which are the two primary criteria for bringing in police onto campus to protect the Columbia. In other words, at the moment in which she was making a speech for which she could be held legally responsible, that is, writing to the police department to call in the police, she refused to say that the students were a clear and present danger to Columbia faculty and persons and property. In other words, while she was the university admin was sending messaging out through all of its channels in by email and public announcements saying that these students posed a danger, that's not the language to talk to to invite the police in. The police, the chief of patrol said, in fact, that the students posed no danger, disavowed the language of clear and present danger, saying that's President Shafik's words, and that the students were protesting peacefully, saying what they wanted to say peacefully, and it in no way resisted arrest.
What happened yesterday? Talk about you have the student encampment on the South Lawn, and then you have the professors going into Lowe Library for